you for downloading this podcast from Sound of Science. Lionel is a VW campervan, but inspired by the words and works of Carl Sagan, Lionel is the spaceship of our imagination. He likes to take people to the edge of the known universe, but before they go, we like to chat to them about music, life and science while we share a delicious pudding. This is Dessert Lionel Discs.
Lionel's passenger today is Dr. Aravind Vijayaraghavan, a graphene lecturer at the University of Manchester. Hello, Aravind.
Hello.
So, graphene.
And hello to Lionel as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, he won't talk to you, he might tweet you. I think it's probably a word a lot of people have heard, possibly not a word a lot of people know exactly what it means. So, what is it?
Well, that's a fair point, actually. People have heard of it because it's been in the news a lot lately. There's been huge amount of government investment both from the UK and the EU, so that obviously anytime money is involved it gets into the news.
Yes.
But I do feel that people don't quite know what it is or don't quite appreciate what it is.
Right.
So it's basically the really unique and amazing thing about graphene, when you break it down, is that it's the world's very first two-dimensional material.
Okay.
Which is to say that everything else in the world around us that we encounter every day is three-dimensional,
mm-hmm.
right? You've got a length, you've got a width, and you have a height.
Mm-hmm.
But graphene is two-dimensional, which means it's like a flat sheet of paper.
Right.
It's got only a length and a width. It doesn't have, well, technically speaking, it has a height.
Yes.
Because everything has a height, or
yes.
even a single atom has a height.
Sure.
But if you look at it from the perspective of an electron,
yeah.
then the electron can only move in two directions. It can't move up and down,
mm-hmm.
which means from the perspective of an electron, it's two-dimensional.
Okay.
And another way of describing that is if you take a piece of paper, which you can also say, oh, this is also flat, it's two-dimensional,
yeah.
but you can have papers of different thicknesses,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
So it's not technically two-dimensional because you can grow it in the third dimension.
Okay.
But graphene, if you put anything above or below it, or if you try to make it thicker,
yeah.
it's no longer graphene.
Right.
So you can only make it bigger in two directions.
Yeah.
So it's a two-dimensional material. It's the world's first two-dimensional material. We never had anything like this before.
Yes.
And that's the real unique aspect of graphene. And everything else comes out of that.
Okay. So what does come out of that?
Well, because it's two-dimensional, and because the electrons are confined to move in two dimensions rather than three, they have very unique properties. For example, they behave like particles of light, not particles with mass.
Mm.
So they zip around the graphene without bouncing into anything, just like a ray of light would.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes very special circumstances to slow the electron down or to stop it.
Right.
Which is, you know, if you look at the electronic structure, the electronic properties of the electron, especially is what we know as the rest mass, then an electron has a zero rest mass, which means it essentially has no mass or no
yeah.
weight.
Yeah.
No mass is the correct word for it,
okay.
Which is the same as a photon. So it behaves like a particle of light, which is the only system that we know of where an electron behaves like a particle of light.
Okay.
Which is again unique. And also, because it's so two-dimensional, it's also extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
It is the strongest material we ever know.
Mm-hmm.
It's also obviously the thinnest material we can ever make because it's only one atom thick.
Sure.
It's also the most conducting when it comes to both heat and electricity. It's extremely stretchable, it's extremely bendable, because, you know, it's like silk, it's like a fabric. You can stretch it and bend it and twist it and do whatever you want with it.
Sure.
And what makes it truly amazing is that it's not exceptional in one aspect. Like, you can say, okay, diamond is a very good conductor of heat, but it's a lousy conductor of electricity, and it's very strong, but it's not flexible. Or you take copper, excellent conductor of electricity, but if you try to bend it, it doesn't bend as well as graphene.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of other things. You can think of like cloth, which is very bendable and flexible, but it's not conducting,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, things like that. So it's graphene is one thing which has got all of these properties rolled into it.
Sure.
That's what makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It seems like the potential for it is incredible. Is there anything, looking back over history, there's been a discovery of anything which would be comparable, so that if we looked at that, we might be able to predict the future of graphene and how much of a difference it will make to our lives?
I think the obvious corollary there is plastics.
Okay.
So you had plastics, which then you could give it any number of different properties. I mean, you have plastics that are used in a variety of different industries, variety of different applications. The difference there is that it's not a single type of plastic that's being used in everything.
Yeah.
It's a family of materials.
Right.
So you have a family of materials, different polymers, different plastics. But when you play around with its structure and properties, you can pretty much give it any property you want.
Yeah.
But it's that versatility which is there in graphene. Mm. The only difference being graphene is one material which can do all of this, rather than a family of materials.
Sure. So plastic is pervasive throughout, you know, technology, healthcare, fun, pretty much everything you can think of, plastics, and it will be the same with graphene.
We hope so, given enough time, given enough interest, given enough funding, given enough, if we're able to manufacture graphene in the large scale, it's again, there are parallels in history. Even if you take something like aluminium, aluminium is everywhere, but there was a time when we didn't have a way of purifying aluminium ore in a cheap process, and then it was more expensive than gold.
Right.
Because there was no way to get it out of the ore.
Yeah.
As soon as the mass production was sorted out, it's now everywhere.
Yeah.
So if you can figure out how to make graphene cheaply, at high quality, then it has the potential to be like plastic.
And that's the focus at the moment then, I presume, is getting to the manufacturing.
Not only that, I mean, there's about 100 people at the University of Manchester working on graphene.
Oh, right, okay.
This includes, you know, academics like me, postgraduate students, postdoctoral researchers, undergraduate students, if you put everything together. But we're working on every aspect of graphene. We're working on how to mass produce graphene. Mm. We're working on how to improve the quality of graphene. We're working on measuring and studying all the different properties of graphene. We're working on different potential applications. So every angle, every aspect is covered.
Oh, right. Okay. It's a story often told, but could you just run me through how it was discovered again?
Well, there was a bit of, you know, being smart and a bit of luck.
Okay.
Which is how a lot of things in science are.
Absolutely.
So they were consciously trying to make graphene. Mm. A lot of people were.
Right.
There was scientists in America, scientists in other parts of Europe, in UK, trying to make graphene because we wanted graphene because the theory of graphene, you know, the equations describing graphene has been around for a long time.
Okay.
So people have theoretically studied graphene for a long time. So at some stage, first we had graphite, which is sort of a three-dimensional version of graphene.
Yeah.
Then we had fullerenes, which is the zero-dimensional version of graphene. Mm-hmm. We had carbon nanotubes, which was the one-dimensional version of graphene. Mm-hmm. And the only thing then missing was the graphene, the two-dimensional version.
Okay.
Which was the hardest to make.
Yeah.
And so people were desperately trying to make it.
Sure.
And then, so this is where the sort of clever bit comes in, where, you take a simple method, which is basically you take graphite and you say, okay, graphite has got layers of carbon atoms. It's like a deck of cards.
Yeah.
How do you make a single card out of that? You just keep cutting the deck till you get a single card. Mm-hmm. So Andrei Gaiman, Kostya Novoselov said, okay, let's take graphite and think of different ways of slicing it down, of cutting it down till you get a single layer. And one of the methods they tried was just by putting graphite between two pieces of sellotape and then pulling the tape apart so that you have a little bit sticking to one side, a little bit sticking to the other side.
Yeah.
This in itself is not new because people have done this before.
Right.
And managed to thin graphene down to maybe 10, 20 layers thick.
Okay.
But they could not get beyond that.
Yeah.
And the reason they couldn't get beyond that was simply because they didn't know how to find it at that stage.
Okay.
It becomes so thin that it's virtually transparent.
Yeah.
And then how do you find it? It's something so small, you don't have the sophisticated techniques to find it. Mm. So then they worked out that if you put graphene, single layer graphene, onto a special surface, which is silicon wafer with a certain thickness of silicon oxide on it, because of the interference contrast, it becomes just obviously visible.
Yeah.
So once they figured that bit out, it became very easy to find it. Mm-hmm. And then you could start making it regularly. Mm-hmm. So that was the really clever bit, where they worked out the equations to figure out where it actually, under what conditions you can actually see it. Because you have to get a number of different parameters right.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it's a mix of, you know, oh, well, this sounds interesting, let's try it.
Yeah.
With, you know, a bit of sort of clever thinking where it's like, okay, this has been tried before, let's see if we can push the limit of it. And then some clever maths where they work out the equation. So it's a bit of all of these things coming together.
Yeah, okay. So that's how it was discovered. And where did you come into the picture? You presumably weren't a lecturer in graphene before it was discovered.
No, so I've been here for about 3 years. But okay. When all the graphene discovery was going on, I was working on carbon nanotubes.
Okay.
So I've been working in carbon nanotubes now for over a decade. Mm-hmm. So that's the background from which I came. Mm-hmm. And like I said, carbon nanotube is related to graphene. It's just the one-dimensional version of graphene.
Right.
A lot of things that we learned from studying carbon nanotubes can be directly applied to graphene.
Right.
So then, when there was a growth in graphene research in Manchester, when they wanted to bring more people in to cover different areas of graphene research, which was not existing here before,
yeah,
that's when I came into the picture.
Okay. Well, you're in the spaceship of our imagination.
Yeah.
You're about to set off to the edge of the known universe. Have you been into space before?
No.
Okay, well, that's new, that's good. Have you been in a camper van before?
No.
Okay, it's all new experiences.
I've been in planes, that's about it.
Okay, yeah, well, they go sort of near enough.
Yeah.
It's just, if you think about that and then a bit further, you'll be fine. Although it's much more comfortable, and you can take your own music and your own films. It's much better than planes.
Well, I've seen some very clear skies from the airplanes. I mean, sometimes it's amazing when you're up there.
Oh, okay.
Pitch black skies.
Yeah, wow. I'm always asleep on planes. So
I can't sleep on planes.
Oh, really?
No. Oh. Don't care how long it is, I can't sleep.
I have a sort of Pavlov's dogs thing. As soon as it gets to the runway, I'm absolutely wide awake, no matter what time of day. As soon as it gets to the runway and just before it starts going, I'm out. That's it.
You're lucky. Yeah. I envy you.
So, anyway, you're going to need some entertainment. You get Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Have you read that?
Yes, I have. Brilliant.
Right. Brilliant, yeah. Absolutely brilliant. The Complete Works of Sir David Attenborough, to remind you of Earth while you're up there.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take a book and a film of your choice. What have you brought with you?
Right, I was looking through my bookshelf to see what would be the most appropriate choice.
Okay.
The first thing that caught my eye was The Hitchhiker's Guide, obviously.
Brilliant.
But it was a bit too bulky, I thought, and I've read it from cover to cover multiple times.
Yeah.
So then I went with The Little Prince.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Which is, again, sort of space or themed, right?
Sure.
I mean, you're bouncing around from planet to planet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's one of my favorite books. It's very, very small, but it is one of my favorite books, so I thought I'll go with that.
Fantastic. Thank you for thinking of this space in here, room, because there's not that much. It is a camper van, and you know, I appreciate that very much. And did you bring a film?
Yes, I have brought a film. Again, I'm rolling with the space theme here.
Okay, great.
I brought, well, it's a two-parter. I bought the box set of Firefly. The DVD of Serenity as well, because they all go together.
That's allowed.
That is allowed. I'm sure that's allowed.
That's definitely allowed.
It brings the story around to it then. So,
yeah.
Yes. So
absolutely.
Again, space theme, and you know, I've still not forgiven Fox for cancelling Firefly.
No.
So figured I'll bring that.
Fox need forgiving for quite a lot of things, mainly their news network. But also,
I will second that.
Yeah.
if you treat it as an alternative to Comedy Central, because Comedy Central provides all the real news, and Fox provides the funny, silly bits. That's how, I mean, for me, like, The Daily Show is my news program.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Bill O'Reilly is my comedy show.
Yeah. That's a much better way. I think I'll get less depressed if I think of it like that. That's fantastic. Thank you. Is it science that got you into this, really? Or is it innovation? Or is it both?
It's an interesting way in which it turned out, because, okay, I'm originally from India. And things work a bit differently there.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, as a student, as a teenager, you get very little choice in what you want to do.
Right.
It's mostly your mum and dad deciding on your behalf.
Okay.
Or you end up in the best university you get into. It doesn't matter what field it's in.
Okay.
Unless you have, like, some debilitating fear of studying medicine or something like that.
Sure.
You get into the best university you get into.
Yeah.
And that's a laborious process. You have to sit through multiple entrance tests and things like that. It depends on what marks you score in your 12th standard, and then you sit through all these entrance exams, and then at the end of all of that, you get into the best university that you're given admission into.
Okay.
And you get into the best course in that university that you can get into.
Yes.
Because usually it's very similar to the UCAS process, so you give your preferences, but you don't just give preference. Yeah, you give preferences on which university, but also which course.
Mm.
And essentially, you end up in what is regarded or ranked as the best.
Right.
You think very little about, oh, you know, I would love to be an astrophysicist, so I want to go into physics. Yeah. It doesn't quite work that way.
Even to the point of you being sort of arts-based or science-based?
Well, I don't want to sound flippant or anything like that, but most of the bright students end up in science and medicine.
Okay.
Which is sort of, it's a cultural thing,
yeah,
honestly.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, medicine's the hardest to get into, but not for merit reasons.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge problem, I would say a problem, honestly, in India with affirmative action.
Right.
And there's a large number of seats in universities are reserved for people who are perceived to be underprivileged.
Right.
I say perceived because
yeah.
the system gets played massively.
Okay.
And this is more prevalent in medicine than it is in science and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So medicine is the hardest to get into,
yeah.
followed by science and engineering,
okay.
followed by the arts.
Okay.
So the harder it is to get into, the more you want to get into it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the more your mom and dad want to get you into it.
Sure.
So, you know, so that's pretty much what I tried as well. I you know, I wrote the medicine entrance exams. I didn't get into any of those.
Okay.
I wrote the engineering entrance exam, and I got into the best engineering university in the country, so that was a no-brainer. I went there.
Which is
the IITs, the Indian Institute of Technology.
Okay.
So they're ranked, they're regarded as among the best undergraduate institutions in the world.
Right.
There's a few of them scattered around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and then once I got into that, and then you have an issue of, like, so which course do I study?
Mm.
And again, they're like the students who get the highest rank pick computer science by default.
Okay.
And then you have, like, electrical engineering, and then mechanical engineering, and then chemical and some. So, you know, you
sure. yeah.
there is sort of a ranking of what people perceive has the best job prospects.
Yes.
And you know, the IT industry is big in India, so everybody goes to computer science.
Okay.
You know, and then manufacturing is big, so everybody goes to mechanical engineering and so on. You know, you get more or less assigned to the course depending on where you are in the rankings of the entrance exam results.
Mm-hmm.
And material science sort of middle ground in that ranking, and that's where I ended up.
Okay.
Because my rank was appropriate
sure.
for that.
Sure. Okay.
So, you see, it's very fatalistic way
yeah.
of things happening. So I ended up being a material scientist for absolutely no choice of my own.
Okay. So imagine that cultural influence didn't exist.
Right.
Little Aravind wandering around.
Yes.
What do you think he would have wanted to be?
Probably medicine, because I was really good at biology in school.
Okay.
Really, I mean, that even now, I tried desperately to sort of get into the life sciences things because I have a real interest in life sciences and biology in general.
Okay.
That was my best subject.
Right.
It was the one that excited and interested me the most.
Right.
But again, you know, things like biochemistry or biotechnology isn't necessarily a big thing in India.
Right.
Or the universities which have that program aren't necessarily ranked very highly.
Okay.
The university I got into, the IIT, didn't have a biotechnology program, so I didn't go for it.
Right.
But if there had been one, I would have gone for it.
Okay. Well, all I'll say to little Aravind, who's in there somewhere, is that had you gone that route, you might not be sitting in the spaceship of our imagination now.
Probably so, not. Yeah. Plus, I have, you know, I realized at some stage in my life that I'm terrified of needles. So I probably wouldn't have become...
okay.
So I probably wouldn't have become a doctor. I might have done research in biology, research in medicine or something like that in the life sciences. But yeah.
Okay. So you're off into space. You're going to need some music while you're up there. What's your first choice?
Yeah, growing up in India, you sort of have a general tendency to listen to Indian film music, movie music,
mm-hmm.
which is what I did, like every good Indian, you have to listen to all the music that comes from the movies there. So there was a movie there which you know for the longest time was my favorite movie, and it was sort of, you know, it's called Dilwale Dulhaniya Le Jayenge. It was, you know, it's a movie that's set in Europe. It's, you know, it's about two people that meet on a Eurorail journey. And,
yeah.
I don't know. It was everybody's favorite movie for a long time. And,
right.
If you go back to somebody who was, you know, a teenager around that time, they will immediately tell you that is their favorite movie. It was
this
huge, massive hit
at
that time.
Okay.
And so probably the first track in that movie, which was... It's Mere Kwabo Me Joy. It's a very, very nice, very melodious song with, you know, I like it because it doesn't have the silly group dancing that's become the staple of Indian movies now, where, you know, you have like the same half a dozen, you know, pelvic moves that everybody does, that's the dance.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have that sort of group dancing. So that's another reason I like it. So after I finished my undergraduate studies in India, then I moved to the States to do my postgraduate.
Okay.
So I, again, you know, I'm following on with my field of study in India.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for universities which were strong in material science.
Yeah.
And I had a few options. I eventually chose to go to Rensselaer Polytechnic. It's a private engineering university, predominantly engineering university in upstate New York.
Okay.
Which is ranked very, very highly in engineering, but it doesn't really... It's not a big university.
Hmm.
So it's probably... It doesn't have, like, a big medicine program or anything like that.
Yeah.
But in engineering, it's very, very good university. It's, like, one of the top 30 in the world, in the U.S. or something like that.
Yeah.
And, they have very strong connections to various industries, like GE is just around the corner, their headquarters, so...
Okay.
They're very close ties with GE and with the semiconductor industry like Intel and companies like that.
Yeah. Okay.
So again, when I went for my postgraduate, I only went there with the intention of doing a master's.
Yeah.
And then going into industry and
you
know, getting a proper job.
Right.
that was the intention.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was, again, you know, a lot of peer pressure.
Okay.
In the sense that everybody around you has the same idea.
Yeah.
You go to the States, you do a master's, and then you go and get a job.
Yeah.
Very few people go there. Even those who go to the States after your undergraduate in India with the intention of doing a PhD want to do a PhD and then go into industry. That's you know, the academic route, academia route is not... something that people think about much when they leave India.
Okay.
So
what happened to you?
Yeah. Damn inspirational professors.
Right, which you're presumably one of them ruining it for everybody else.
Yes,
now,
exactly. So now I'm trying to be one of them ruining it for everybody else. You're exactly right. You know, it's payback time.
Yeah. Okay, is there one in particular, or?
Yeah, so I started off in doing my my master's research in a very industrial project where, you know, there was, you know, it was like you have a very, very specific problem where you take something and make it 5% better, and industry loves it because that's going to save them a load of money.
Sure.
But it wasn't intellectually stimulating, and I realized, I knew very on early in my life that if something doesn't excite me, if something doesn't interest me, if I find it monotonous or boring,
yeah,
I'm not going to do it.
Okay.
You know, and once you're sort of away from home and you can take things into your own hands,
yeah,
you can, you know, you have the option of saying, okay, screw that, I'm going to do something adventurous.
Okay.
So then I said, okay, let me finish my master's and go on and do a PhD and do something that's really exciting, very basic, has got absolutely no chance of being useful.
Yeah.
there was a professor at Rensselaer called Professor Ajayan, Polycule Ajayan, who was one of the pioneers in carbon nanotubes. He was there in Japan when carbon nanotubes were discovered, and he was in the field right from the start.
Sure.
And, you know, it was only about, you know, it was a field that was only a few years old.
Yeah.
It was, you know, there was no perceived application at that stage, similar to what graphene was,
sure,
a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It was basic research, and, you know, you got to play with very, very cool equipment, and, you know, you got to go make measurements and see things that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting. So I said, okay, let me do a PhD in carbon nanotubes. And
yeah,
he was very kind enough to take me on as a student.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started working with him. And, yeah, so he was my inspiration for going into academia because as a professor, he was, you know, he was very well respected in the community. And, you know, he used to travel the world giving lectures. He was invited to speak here and speak there. And he had research collaborations all over the world. He was writing books and he was writing papers. And, you know, it was the sort of, you really take pride in what you do, and you really have a sense of ownership. This is my research. I discovered this. I invented this.
Yeah.
This is mine. And everybody around the world recognizes you as a leader in a certain field.
Okay.
So all of those things attracted me, plus things like, you know, I always liked teaching. So, you know, you have an opportunity to teach.
Mm.
You have an opportunity to, you know, do really cool research. But like I said before, you see something for the first time that nobody in the world has seen before.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff really, you know,
yeah,
caught my attention. And,
sure,
you know, after about a year of doing my PhD, I had made up my mind that I wanted to be a professor.
Yeah. So is there any music from around that time that you're going to take with you?
Well, even when I was in India, it wasn't just sort of the Hindi or Tamil,
okay,
film music I was listening to, but you had rather limited opportunity to discover new music.
Mm.
A lot of things you listened to was well-established music.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have iTunes, you couldn't download just one track.
Sure.
You had to go out and you had to buy the whole CD.
Yeah.
And very often you had very little option of previewing the CD. So,
mm,
you know, and new music from would not really filter in that quickly.
Sure.
So by the time the music became popular in India, it was already, you know, done and dusted within the States.
Yeah.
But anyway, most of the music that I and my friends listened to was stuff that was, you know, sort of in from the 70s, 80s, 90s, which was, you know, well-established music. You know,
yeah,
we were listening to all the sort of classic rock and stuff that everybody listens to.
Mm.
But one group that particularly that I liked was Dire Straits.
Okay.
And I used to listen to loads of Dire Straits.
Yeah.
And then, just about the time when I moved to the States,
mm-hmm,
that was when sort of Mark Knopfler was still establishing his solo career.
Mm-hmm.
He did Golden Heart, which was his first solo album, and then just when I moved there, he released Sailing to Philadelphia,
okay,
which was his second solo album,
mm-hmm,
and that was, if I remember correctly, that was the first CD I bought when I was in the States.
Okay.
So that's very fond memories of that, and I listened to that CD a lot because it was sort of like I was discovering like new music just when it came out, which,
yeah,
I didn't really have a chance,
yeah,
to do,
yeah,
when it came to sort of Western music. So I think I'll go with Wanderlust.
Okay.
Again, which plays into sort of,
sure,
the whole, I really like traveling, so
yeah,
I think, yeah, I would say I do have a feeling of Wanderlust.
Big black cloud on a yellow plane, sure enough it looks like rain. packing up all our faith and trust. Me and the wonder.
We'll be able to sate some of that wanderlust by sending you off to the edge of the known universe.
Oh, yeah, it's the ultimate wanderlust, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything particularly you're looking forward to seeing when you're out there?
Oh, gosh. No, I can't think of any one thing that I would like to see more than something else. I mean, everything is just absolutely fascinating. I love looking at the stars.
And I'm on the edge of an endless fall. Sure enough, got to go now. Get on that bus. Me and the wonders.
You've been introduced to all sorts of new music when you've moved over to the States, but it must have been a culture shock in other ways, living in New York, if nothing else. Or was it very similar to, in any way?
It wasn't very similar to India, but funnily enough, it wasn't a culture shock either.
Okay.
I don't know why. I mean, I sort of felt right at home.
Okay.
Honestly, I mean, yeah, you have a shock to your system in the sense that you don't know how things work.
Mm.
Practical things.
Mm.
You know, everything from going shopping to you know, paying your bills.
Mm.
is a new way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense it was a shock, but it wasn't like that's not a culture thing. It's just it's a very practical thing. And
okay.
You learn it, you know, you ask somebody, right, I have my first electricity bill, what the hell do I do with it?
Okay.
And they say, okay, do this, or, you know, how the hell do I open a bank account? Go here and
do that.
So those are all practical things. You get over it very quickly.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have a culture shock in the sense, you know, I felt right at home. I made friends and that was it.
Great.
So it was a very smooth transition.
That's great. And is New York's a big city?
The university is not in New York City.
Okay.
It's in upstate New York.
Sorry.
It's about 2 hours north of New York City.
Right.
It's in Troy.
Right.
Which is the most what's the right depressing town in the world.
Okay. Right.
Which I didn't know before I went there.
Right.
Otherwise,
okay,
I'd have gone to Austin, which was my other option.
Okay.
But. There was very little there to do.
You're right.
The university was fairly small.
Yeah.
You had to drive half an hour to get to the movies.
Oh, right.
So, you know, everything was a half an hour drive away.
Yeah.
Within about 6 months of being there, I realized I couldn't survive without a car.
Yeah.
By the end of, I think about 9 months of being there, I bought my car, which
right.
was like, I realized I just can't make it without a car.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that was probably the best decision I made there.
Right.
So it was all about friends and, you know, hanging out with people.
Yeah.
And New York City wasn't that far away. Boston wasn't that far away.
Yeah.
I had friends in both places who were going to university there. Cornell University again. So everything was about 2 to 3 hours. So Cornell was 3 hours west.
Right.
New York was 2 to 3 hours south. Boston was 3 hours east.
Yeah.
So I would try to get out of there every weekend as far as possible.
Yeah. Okay. Did you get a good car?
No, it was a used car, about 10 years old used car. That's all I could afford as a student.
Yeah, sure.
But it was a red Honda Civic Coupe.
Okay. So
it was red. It had two doors.
Yeah.
And it was you felt like you were literally sitting on the road because it was such a low car.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure to drive.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
I love my car.
Is there, presumably you were listening to music as you were on these journeys?
Yes, constantly. Well, I was listening to a variety of different, I was listening to all this sort of stuff, like everything from Dire Straits to Pink Floyd that was going, that I used to listen to.
Yeah.
But I think I discovered Bob Dylan around that time.
Oh, okay.
Bob Dylan was not a big name in India.
Right.
I don't know why. Maybe it was just that, I didn't come across him.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew who Bob Dylan was.
Yeah, sure.
But his music, at least for me, was not a big deal till I moved to the States.
Okay.
And then I discovered Bob Dylan, and I listened to a lot of Dylan.
Okay.
Because, of course, he has this massive
sure.
body of work.
Yeah.
Every one of which was, is a good song.
Yeah.
I can't think of a bad Bob Dylan song.
No.
And he's written about 500 of them.
Yeah.
So, it's a three-hour journey, and I don't know why. I don't like to switch between genres. In fact, I rarely even switch between albums.
Okay.
If I listen to music, I listen to the entire album.
Great.
Most albums these days have maybe one good song in them.
Oh, okay.
And that's why, things like iTunes, people download the one song they want to listen to.
Yeah.
I don't download a single song. If I buy an album, I buy the whole album, or I don't bother with it.
Yeah. You Dire Straits, you Bob Dylan.
Oh, those, absolutely. You had to listen to it as an album because there was a thread that ran through and there was a theme and there was, all the songs were somehow felt connected.
Yeah.
And, but no, that's not the case with most people these days.
No.
There are a few exceptions, but I listened to a lot of Dylan when I was driving.
Okay, and are you taking any with you?
Definitely. I can't imagine leaving without a Dylan album.
Okay.
What happened in Boston yesterday, and I moved to the States a few months before 9/11, and then you had this whole aftermath of that with all the wars. I would listen to Masters of War.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood
flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. He's thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. A foe threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn.
One of my motivations for going into academia was the fact that it takes you all over the world. And I did bounce around a fair bit before I eventually landed in Manchester.
Okay.
My first taste was I was in Japan for 6 months during my PhD, doing sort of internship in my last year. And I decided I didn't want to live there.
Okay.
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was great to visit.
Mm.
But that's where I actually had my culture shock.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Why is that?
I think the... literally, the culture is fascinating as an external viewer, where you look at it and you go, oh, it's a beautiful country. They've got very good architecture, very unique customs, and you can go there, live there for a few months, and experience all of that. But it just I wouldn't feel comfortable living there. The language is a big problem to begin with,
sure.
Which is for me is probably the primary issue with living in an Asian country. But in general, I didn't feel comfortable. I don't know why.
Okay.
But then I decided I didn't want to live. I didn't want to move to Japan or China.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got an opportunity to do a postdoc in Germany.
Okay.
And I've always liked Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's sports or sports probably was one of the big things I liked about Germany.
Yeah.
But I, for some reason, I actually even took a year of German when I was doing my undergraduate in India.
Really?
You could take courses that were outside of your core curriculum. And mm-hmm. I said, I like Germany, I'll take German.
Okay.
So, I said, okay, fine, I'll go give Germany a shot. I've heard a lot of good things about Germany from their science perspective as well.
Yeah, sure.
So I got a fellowship to go there. I got a Humboldt fellowship to go and do a postdoctoral research in Germany. So I went there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I intended to stay there for a year or two, and I ended up staying there nearly for 4 years.
Okay.
I really liked the place work-wise, and it gave me a base to explore Europe.
Yeah.
I traveled all over Europe, and it was great.
Yeah.
After about two and a half years of being there, I started looking for an academic position.
Right.
At that stage, it was back in the States.
Okay.
I sent out a bunch of applications, and I was waiting to hear back, and that's when the economy collapsed.
Okay.
Very bad timing.
Yeah.
Everybody stopped hiring.
Yeah.
And, I ended up staying on for a year longer in Germany.
Okay.
Which was, not ideal, but it was fine.
Yeah.
Scientifically, it was very productive, so I wouldn't complain.
Okay.
And then I said, okay, well, if the sort of academic positions are not going to open up, let me see if I can get another sort of postdoctoral position, but somewhere else, because I don't want to be in the same place too long.
Yeah.
And then I got a postdoc back in the States at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, if I wasn't getting an academic position, a postdoc at MIT is possibly the next best option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So I went back to the States to do my postdoc there for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
But halfway through that, I was still sending out applications and things like that, and I heard about options at Manchester in graphene, and by that time I had already got into graphene. I was already working on graphene.
Okay.
Even when I was in Germany, because that was the next best thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, the next big thing.
Sure.
And you could use what you've learned with carbon nanotubes, apply it to graphene. So
sure.
I was already moving into graphene. I moved into graphene even more when I moved to MIT.
Yeah.
And then I heard about these options in Manchester, which is called the home of graphene.
Yeah.
So I figured, well, if I'm going to do graphene, I might as well do it in Manchester.
Yeah.
So I applied here. I came. I had my interview. I got the position. So
yeah.
I said, right. It was actually you know, I could not have asked for anything better in terms of where I would be and what I would be working on. You know, I was working on what is arguably the most exciting thing in material science,
sure,
that's going on at the moment.
Yeah.
In the best university for that.
Yes.
So yeah, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah. Well, I can see why it would draw you in, but we're lucky to have you, I would say, for a little while.
Thank you.
You obviously go off again at some point when something else.
Graphene is all over the world, honestly.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There are, you know, the States has got some very good universities doing graphene. Even within the UK, Cambridge has got an excellent graphene group.
Mm-hmm.
London universities have graphene groups. Asia's got graphene groups.
Mm.
Europe. So this graphene research is all over the world, and
yeah,
there are some very, very good people everywhere, very good groups.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anywhere else which is as diverse as Manchester is.
Okay.
And where, you know, where I'm getting the sort of support that I get from the people. And
yeah.
It takes a lot to keep me in one place.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, speaking of which, we do need to get you out there. We've
yes.
got two more pieces of music to listen to. What's up next?
I really like the Corrs.
Okay.
So it was, I think they released their first album when I was still in India.
Yeah.
And that's when I heard them for the first time.
Yeah.
And then again, it was, the subsequent albums were very, very good as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the last album, they've been quiet for a while. I don't know why. I think they're all busy having babies, but
okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, their last album they released was actually probably when I was in Germany.
Yeah.
They released an album called Home, which was sort of, it was very folksy Irish,
mm-hmm.
Irish folk music.
Yep.
And I do like Irish folk sounds a lot.
So what have you brought with you?
I don't know if this is the sort of thing you were looking for, but I brought my phone.
Okay.
My full, well, okay, the correct word for that apparently is my foldlet.
Oh.
It's the Galaxy Note 2, which is too big to be regarded as a phone.
Okay.
Too small to be regarded as a tablet.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think, if I could think of one device that can do everything I want it to do,
yeah,
and it satisfies my gadget geek side,
yeah,
it has to be that. So I was thinking, you know, it does everything I want it to do. I don't know if you get email in space.
No, there's only one way to find out.
So I'll keep my phone on. We'll see if I get email in space. Maybe yeah. I'll pick up some extraterrestrial email.
You're entirely possible. The guys on the International Space Station tweet from there. So.
Oh yeah, so you know there might be something. There might be something.
Absolutely, you can pick theirs up immediately, and then once, as you go away, it's probably going to have to be alien things.
Exactly, and you know it's got everything. It's got my music on there.
Yeah,
it's got pictures on there, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's got. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Mm. I really don't sit down and read books on paper. Mm. So it's got a lot of my audiobooks on there, and it's got it's got a lot of, you know, I can. Use it to take pictures. I can, you know, I thought it was very, very appropriate. And, you know, and this is an interesting piece of information.
Mm-hmm.
Every time, God, I can't believe I'm saying this on air. But the ringtone for getting text messages is the Star Trek communicator ringtone.
Oh, okay.
So it had to be that.
Yeah. We'll get you back in time to see the new Star Trek film, obviously,
yes.
While we get you back in terms of Earth very soon indeed. But yes. You must be looking forward to that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Are you a fan of the redo, the J.J. Abrams?
Yes, I think they've done justice.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think it'll be good.
Yeah.
I think it'll be good.
It looks good. It looks good.
It looks very, visually, it's very, very good.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's really, I'm looking forward to it. Right, it's getting late. It's actually not getting cold. Spring has sprung. But
yes, finally.
Yes.
It's almost summertime.
It is. Yeah. Did you bring it, Puddy? Oh. Flan. Let's dig in. Set off for the edge of the known universe, but before you go, I'd just like to talk to you about something. You've been awarded the Josh Awards, which is the Joshua Phillips Award for Innovation in Science Engagement.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What does that mean?
It's two things. I mean, the award on one hand is a recognition of science communication, public engagement work that I've been doing for the last couple of years.
Okay.
So I've been doing the public engagement from graphene perspective.
Mm.
There's been a lot of interest in the general public about graphene because it's been in the news a lot.
Sure.
And everybody wants to know about it, they want to learn about it. So I've been doing a lot of different things, like exhibits at science festivals,
okay.
Going to schools and talking to them about graphene. We have a stand where I developed this hands-on activity where you could come and make your own graphene.
Oh, okay.
So everybody likes to do that.
Yeah.
And then you know, things like I do a lot of public lectures on graphene, for example. There's this fantastic concept called Cybar. I'm not sure if you've heard
of
it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So there's Cybars all over the UK, but there seems to be a really strange concentration of them around Manchester. I don't know why.
Okay, yeah.
There's at least about half a dozen Cybars in and around Manchester.
Absolutely.
So I've been to them to talk to people in a pub over a pint of beer about graphene.
Fantastic.
Which
yeah.
is great.
Yeah, yeah.
I've given lectures, I've spoken to kids in schools. So I've done a lot of this science festivals as well. So I've done a lot of graphene, and it's not just graphene, it's nanoscience, nanotechnology in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's partly in recognition of that. But the other half is the Josh Award gives me the position of science communicator in residence at MoSI, at the Museum of Science and Industry, during the Science Festival.
Manchester Science Festival.
During the Manchester Science Festival this year.
Yeah.
And as part of that, I will be developing an event at the Science Festival, a one-day event. Something unique. We're throwing around a few ideas.
Okay.
I think we'll nail something down in the coming weeks.
But
it'll be an activity that all the visitors to the museum during the Science Festival can take part in.
Yeah.
So, something sort of like a crowdsourced activity, if you wish, that everybody can contribute to, and something that, you know, that they also learn something from.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, something that is big and that'll catch the attention of people that are like, oh, I want to go and do that.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I look forward to hearing about that and experiencing it. Okay, we've got one more piece of music. Thank you very much indeed. It's been absolutely fascinating. A real pleasure to talk to you as well. The last piece of music is something you're going to listen to as you take off, as you set off for the edge of the universe. What have we got?
This is probably inappropriate for setting off on a spaceship.
it's okay, Lionel doesn't mind at all.
One of my favorite groups at the moment is the Decemberists.
Okay.
So they're an independent indie rock group from, I think they're from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
They have very good music. They're one of the few groups now that put entire albums that, you know, like in the old days where it follows a theme.
Yeah.
There's a underlying tune that repeats itself and all that sort of stuff. And I said it's inappropriate because one of the underlying themes of all their albums is that the protagonist in every song dies. I don't want to think of it morosely, but every song has a massive death count.
Okay.
and most of their songs are themed around different ways of killing people.
Okay.
It's bizarre. It's
yeah.
brilliant, but it's bizarre.
Yeah.
And their latest album has a song about the end of the world.
Okay.
It's a post-apocalyptic song.
Right.
So, but I love it because it's got a lot of very... They make a lot of literary references and things like that.
Mm.
You know, it's a very good song. It makes fun of the Republican candidates, which is always a good thing.
There's no problem there.
It's appropriately titled "Calamity Song" by the Decemberists.
Okay, fantastic. We'll pop it on. Great. I hopefully you won't come back to a post-apocalyptic world. thank you again. Enjoy your trip here, Lionel. I'm sure he's going to learn a lot from you. Things out there.
I'm going to learn so much.
It's fantastic. It's been genuinely a great pleasure to talk to you.
It's been brilliant. Thank you for having me on.
No problem at all. Enjoy your trip.
Thank you. And I believe California succumbed to the fault line. Heave relief as scores of end.